be. Welcome to Observations. I am here with Kirk. How are you this fine day?
Fine. Thank you, sir.
Good.
Good.
Over the last couple of weeks, Kirk has had the opportunity to pursue a project that that came to our attention. And the project was that we're noticing a significant rise in not just anti-Semitism, but in some of the most absurd conspiracies about Jews. And what we find is that there's a growing number of people, and these vary between Muslims, right-wing wackos like the KKK, and Christians, who, out of envy primarily, have come up with these absurd conspiracies to suggest that Jews really aren't Jews, that they really don't exist as a race derived from Abraham, and that the ones that do exist are derived from other peoples, and they're satanic, they're evil, they're all religious and manipulative. Their Talmud is this grotesque book that justifies the slaughter and rape of Gentiles, and that collectively they are trying to both enslave and control the world. And the envy appears to be that, well, in Islam, it's obvious that the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms was written to Jews on behalf of Jews and recorded by Jews, and a lot of stunning historical facts and promises made to the Jews. And the Quran claims that it's based on and confirms the Torah, so therefore all of those promises made to Jews must really have been made to the Arabs. Christians recognize that Yosha, who they call Jesus, was somehow changed and created a new religion and did away with the Torah, even though he said exactly the opposite. And that, therefore, all of the promises that God made to Israel must really be to their church, even though there isn't one iota of evidence to suggest that is true, and a mountain of evidence to affirm that it's false. And so it is out of a jealousy towards these people that there is an attack. And the attack is also amongst the socialist secular humanists in the West, in Europe, who I think are jealous for another reason, which is they've created a religion of man. And if you really look at one race of people, they are disproportionately successful, brilliant, inventive. And there's one group of people that don't need to be manipulated to refrain from the kind of bad behavior that political correctness is designed to rein in. So here we have a growing amount of fake news and conspiracies all to demean Jews. It's growing rapidly around the world. And so I asked Kirk to watch some videos that were promoted by a man that we once thought we knew and liked, who has gone way off the deep end in terms of his lack of thinking. And so you've done 2 weeks of research on what really is the history of these people. What did God have to say about them? What do we know about them?
Yeah. Well, what I did is I wrote to you this week as I asked myself some questions like, who are the Yehudim, who are the Jews,
mm-hmm.
Who are the Israelites?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another group that factors into this, who are the Zara Yehuda, because they play a role as well. And I also, and if it were not so, then yeah, we wouldn't have talked so much about it. You know, mm-hmm. Each one of these he speaks a lot about. And you've covered the diaspora, and you've covered the 70 CE and 135 and so thoroughly on the southern tribes, the surprising
mm-hmm.
Yehuda. So I didn't really need to go over that in any great detail, other than just keeping in context of what else we're talking about.
Yeah, I think just for somebody that's not up to speed on these things, Yahuda, and in the plural, Yahudim.
Mm-hmm. Related to Yah.
Yeah, means related to Yah or relate to Yah. And it's they're one of the 12 tribes. But mm-hmm. they are the tribe in the sense of the center of Yahweh's attention. Jerusalem is in the midst of Yahuda.
Mm-hmm.
Dod was from the tribe of Yahuda, and he loved no one more. Yosha, mm-hmm. From the tribe of Yahuda. But Yahuda is one of 12 tribes.
Right.
They're important because they survived both the... principally the Assyrian attack on Yisrael, Ephraim, the northern 10 tribes. They survived it and would endure for a longer period of time than be hauled off to Babylon, but they came back from Babylon.
Right.
And so while they are one of the 12 tribes, they are the tribe. And the Jew is really a errant transliteration of Yahud.
Yes.
In the singular. Now, this means that Yisrael represents all 12 tribes, and really 13 if you consider the Lowi, the Levites. And they were all sons of, descendants of each of these tribes, Jacob, who Yahweh renamed Yisrael. And so Yisrael is inclusive of all of the tribes, and this race of people descended from Sarah and Abraham through Yishak and then Jacob, with Yahud being a subset of Yisrael. So that's the first part of it. The second part is there are two diasporas that are the most... in terms of taking place within the last 2,000 years, because there was two primary diasporas prior to that, one being when the Assyrians hauled the northern tribes, Ephraim, comprising 10 of the 12 tribes, off into slavery into Assyria, and then within 150 years thereabouts of that, the Babylonians hauled the Yahudim off into slavery in Babylon. But the Romans did it twice. One under Titus, where the temple was destroyed in 70 CE. There's a triumphal arch outside of the Colosseum that shows the Jews and the treasures of the temple being brought into Rome, therefore being brought into Europe. Along with the Jewish slaves, the money from the temple, robbed from the temple, was used to fund the construction of the Colosseum, and the primary slaves building it were these Jews. So they were hauled into Europe. And then in the second diaspora, Hadrian came back, tried to bring all the Jews that had been sent in various places around the world back to Israel so he could wipe them out, either at that or enslave them. And he essentially... pulled every Jew out of Yisrael and hauled them off into captivity, at least those that he didn't kill. And most of those hauled into captivity were hauled into to Europe at that time. So you have captives in Assyria, captives in what was Babylon in Persia, captives in, of course, Egypt, where they were slaves for 400 years, and then captives brought up throughout Europe, as well as Jews fleeing all of these various attacks on them. Interesting, by the way, Kirk,
mm-hmm.
there isn't a case where the Jews were enslaved because they went out trying to conquer someone else and lost.
Yeah. They came calling, knocking at their door.
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct. So that gets you through what you've just summarized.
One side of the equation. The and what I did is, before I began, a lot of this was just plain thinking. I mean, why...
Mm-hmm.
Why are certain people, why do they hate them so much?
Right.
And we've already touched on it, and we've kind of given the answer ahead of time, which I think we can prove pretty good. The jealousy of who's going to rule, because that was the promise to Judah, was the Torah and the scepter. And but the, most of the world doesn't care one way or the other unless it's the UN voting for whatever reason. The Chinese don't care. The Mongolians don't sit around all day worried about the what the Yehudim doing, or most of the Asians, if you eliminate the large population of Muslims there,
correct,
ought to hate them. They have to be taught.
Right.
South Americans are not yet. It seems to be
South Americans. There's a lot of anti-Semitism. Yeah, there's a lot of anti-Semitism in South America, but only because
there's Europeans there.
Yeah, the influence of Roman Catholicism.
Yeah, Roman Catholic.
And there is some anti-Semitism in Africa, but it's only because of the influence of Islam.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't for Islam and Roman Catholicism, there would be no anti-Semitism in the Americas or in Africa, nor in Asia. None.
Yeah, I found it extraordinarily telling where it's coming from. It has to be told, and has to be told by Christianity or Islam or these power brokers of Europe.
But what's really interesting is that the legacy of Islam and Europe and of course, the Middle East, where Islam came out of, and Roman Catholicism in Europe, and the Jews being hauled into those places in captivity. Those are the anti-Semitism exists in the region where Jews were hauled into slavery. And even as slaves with nothing, the Jews, of course, were brighter and more inventive, more capable than the average Gentile in those regions. And there was a lot of jealousy just on their ability to outperform, even with, you know, it's like, you know, the African-Americans here say, back in the 1600s and the 1700s, we were slaves, and therefore, you know, 10 generations later, you know, you owe us something because, you know, our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were treated poorly. And with Jews, there's never any... Yeah, you owe us something because you hauled us here as slaves. No, they just outworked, outthought other people. And so there is this animosity, knowing two things. One is the Roman Catholic Church, of course, and its influence as it grew out of Rome. It knew intimately that all of the promises that God ever made were only made to Jews and never made to their church, ever. And so they're jealous for that reason. And, of course, the Quran is based on rabbis reading Talmud stories to Muhammad and him twisting them to serve his interest. And so the Muslims know that, you know, everybody that mattered is Jewish. And so there's jealousy there.
And that's never ceased.
That's the origin of it. You don't have to dig much deeper than that to know that is where the jealousy exists. And outside of those influences, both in location and religion, it doesn't exist.
That's correct. And it should be obvious to anyone looking.
Yeah.
Well, what I did, Craig, of course, you've seen my notes that I sent you, but and I talked a lot about what we just talked about there, and then I thought in trying to prove this premise of who they are, where they went, and another little group called Zara Judah, which I find terribly interesting, as part of the picture. You could go through just the archaeology that happens from the 1800s on forward, and you can trace a whole group of people by their artifacts they found in their tombs and so forth. I didn't do that because there's lots of books on that. Anyone who wants to search, it's not hard. They're on TV all the time. And they all come back to the Middle East. But what I do find very interesting is I went two different ways. In particular, I went to what does Yah say about all these things, and because that would be the final factor. And I listed several things where he mentions the tribes and where they would go and what would happen to them. And then I also went through the emblems. Uniquely to the Western democracies and the U.S. and Great Britain is they carry the same banners that were used by all the Israelites and the House of Yehuda as well from the ancient times. The only place where it happens is it is overwhelming. If it was a little bit of a coincidence, you could dismiss it, but you can't. I can't. I've studied it in a great deal still from many, many years long ago, and then I just came back to it recently. Just to check it with my filter. And I do have a filter, and the filter Let me mention real quickly,
mm-hmm.
when you study stuff like this and you go through what Yahweh has to say, I have to keep in mind that, and there's a reason for it, I have to keep in mind that Yahweh says he's only going to save thousands. He's not going to save millions, and he's not going to save billions.
Correct.
He tells us, we've already calculated pretty close, that his return to being around 2033 in Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
And he's only coming back for a remnant of Judah and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not going after the goyim of all over the world.
Yeah, and by the way, there's something interesting here that I've probably been misleading on in the past. And that is that while it's generally assumed that there are about 15 million Jews on the planet today, about half in Israel and half in the rest of the world, with half of those in the rest of the world. Overwhelming preponderance of the United States. And that Yahweh says that two out of every three during the second half of the tribulation are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only one third. But what we, and he's going to, and anti-Semitism is going to get so bad that long before that, he's going to, at least, not long, maybe a few years before that, he's going to draw all of his people out of the various countries of the world and bring them back to Israel, the only place they could keep them safe and protect them. We really don't know, A, how many people that Yahweh would consider to be descendants of Israel and Yehuda, how many people really qualify from his, using the genetic markers that he will use. We don't know. And my guess is it's probably less than the 15 million, but there could be people who don't know who are, and people who think they are that are not.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing about this is that we don't really know how many are killed prior to the worst part of the tribulation.
Yeah,
and it's not the we're not telling me how many are killed during the whole tribulation, but just the end of it.
Yeah.
And so we really don't know. And in the second statement that he etched in stone was really clear that his mercy is for the thousands who closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions of his covenant.
Right.
You know, thousands doesn't give you much wiggle room to get to millions.
No. No. Not at all.
No, it doesn't. So, and God's never been, impressed with numbers. I mean, that's one of the reasons why when Yahusha said that the way to death is broad, and many there are that find it, to death and destruction, and the way to life is narrow, and very few, enter through that gate. It's always been that way, and will continue to be that way. Most of you just don't get it, that, to make a religion popular, I think it must be true because it's popular. Well, according to God, if it's popular, it isn't true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an understatement. So, Well, what I did to prove the thesis, so to speak, I first wanted to filter everything through the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with some things. I'm going to lightly cover some of this stuff. If you hear me rattling my papers, I do beg your pardon, because I need to check my notes here as we go. But if you go to Bereshith or Genesis 12:1-3, you'll find that that's when Yahweh first talks to Abraham, and he tells him he's going to turn him into a great nation. And the word for nations is goyim. There would be no reason to say Yehuda at this point, because that's the great-grandchild. And the great numbers of the, as we already know today, the great numbers of Yehudim were quite small, millions rather than hundreds of
keep
millions.
In mind that there's a lot of people that claim to be descendants of and beneficiaries of Abraham.
Right.
And the vast preponderance of them, the overwhelming preponderance of them, and by the way, great doesn't mean great in terms of good, it just means numerous.
Numbers.
Numbers. Is that Christians think that all the promises, the covenant promises made to Abraham, are theirs.
Yeah.
Replacement theology. That's essential to Roman Catholicism and Christianity. And the Muslims claim exactly the same thing through Ishmael. And through Ishmael, you do have 1.5 billion Muslims, all who claim to be descendants of Ishmael through Abraham. And so, it's not surprising that lots of heathen people would be descended from Abraham because Christianity at 2.5 billion claims that they are,
mm-hmm.
and Muslims at 1.5 billion claim that they are. Last time I checked, 4 billion people is many.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's me, yeah. Let's pause for a minute. I'm going to go to a little chart that I sent you on page 3.
By the way,
three.
That group of, that large number of Goyim.
Yeah.
On that large number of Goyim, there isn't anything that says that those Goyim are going to be blessed, are going to get a benefit, are a part of his God's plan, that there's something good about them. It's just that there's going to be a lot of them.
There's going to be a lot of them.
A lot of them, and boy, yeah. There are.
So if you're looking for the lost tribes, per se, mm-hmm. then there has to be a large number of them, and they have to be identifiable. They were lost in prophecy, which we'll get to in a few minutes, or if not today, the next time. They explains they won't be known as my people,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to be cursed. And I'll go to Korah 26 for that. But just so that the people listening, if you not familiar with the lineage, let me go over that chart just a minute, and we'll go through who the players are.
Okay.
You've got Abraham and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the line it's going to go through. When he ran off in the tent with Ishmael's mama,
mm-hmm.
Yahweh said, well, why can't we have Ishmael? And I'm over, and he said, no.
No, so, absolutely not.
Right, and if you go down a little bit on his chart, Abraham and Sarah had Yishak, and Yishak produced Jacob and Esau.
Mm-hmm.
Esau didn't give a flip about the promises because he sold his birthright for a bowl of food.
Right.
And Jacob wanted it desperately, so he walked away from it, and that's the problem. If you walk away from it, now Ishmael had no choice. He was kicked out.
By the way, free will.
I don't want you there. Yeah, you ain't part
right,
of
free
it.
Will. What do you want? Yeah, you really got to want to be part of the covenant
Yahweh don't want you.
That is correct.
You know, that's why it's called Yisrael.
Right. So
endure.
So desire,
choice, will, is, and
yeah.
so forth.
Choice is vastly more important and mean part of God's promises than is race.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it must be because, once again, Abraham comes out of Babylon. Sarah comes out of Babylon.
Right.
Yishak is a product of two Babylonians.
Yes.
In exile.
Right.
By choice.
Yes.
So don't get confused, you know, about who they are.
Right.
Now, if you go down the line of Ishmael, then in our last time we got together on one of these reports, we found out that Esau begat a guy named Amalek,
mm-hmm.
and that became the Amalekites, and that's they're synonymous with Islam. Yahweh don't mm-hmm. care anything about these people other than where they intersect back with Yehudim.
Correct.
It's not his deal. Now, when Sarah died, Abraham, let's eliminate another group so we can stop worrying about them.
Yeah, because, for example, on Ishmael, he said, you know, his descendants will be wild asses of men. They'll
mm-hmm.
raise their hands against their brother's hand will be raised against them, and they'll live in hostility with the entire world.
Yeah.
That's a pretty apt depiction of today's Islamic chaos.
Yeah. And if you study the Amalekites, I mean, my gosh, there's nobody like them but Islam.
Right.
I mean, that's the characteristic from the start. Now, after Sarah died, I'm going to skip forward just a minute before we get back mm-hmm. to the main line.
Mm-hmm.
Abraham remarries, and he has six sons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're inconsequential. That was nice for his old age, and it's wonderful he had a family, but that has nothing to do with the promises. We're already told it's going to go to Yishak.
Mm-hmm.
Left.
Mm-hmm.
And from that it goes through, and Esau has walked away from it, cared nothing about it, and Jacob has, now the promises go through Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob has 12 sons. He has Reuben, Simon, Beloi, Yehudim, Dan, Naphtali. Now, some of these I'll pronounce like the English transliteration, so forgive me on that. It's Yishakar, Asher, Gad. Zebulun, I think, is the way it's pronounced. Yosef and Benjamin. So now we have 12 children, 12 tribes.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to divide that. I'm going to divide those into two major groups, Yehuda, that dominates the two tribes, or plus the Loi in the southern kingdom. And you have Joseph, who winds up being the main, or his children wind up becoming the dominant tribe and the ten tribes of the, they became eventually the Northern Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
Of Manasseh and Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's an interesting thing, and I would like to tell that little story in just a second. Yehuda, as you know, he has a son. He actually has three.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, this is a really interesting story. Let me cover this because this is a whole other line that no one talks about. And then he marries a woman, or rather he has a daughter-in-law called Tamar. This is in Genesis 38:6. I feel very it's interesting. It has a lot to do with this particular line of people that we'll pursue, and we're probably going to have to take a few days for me to get all through this stuff. But in Genesis 38:6, we find the story of Tamar, and that's his daughter-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
He has a son called E-R, I guess, who was evil, we're told, and Yahweh puts him to death, or he dies. Then his brother refuses to take over the duties of the dead brother and produce a child by her. And Yahweh punishes him. Then Yehuda tells Tamar, well, don't worry, I have another son, but he's too young to have children. So wait till he's grown up, and I'll give him to you, and we'll marry y'all off, and you will have a son conceived through y'all. So now we have three sons, and one of them is too young, and Tamar goes back to her family home. It's very kind of a really intriguing little story. She goes back to her family home, and after that, some time passes, and Judah's wife dies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a little bit lonely, and he goes over to an area near where she's living. And she finds out about it. And she dresses up like a prostitute. And he doesn't recognize her, and he goes into the tent with her. But and she says to him, well, what do you pay me for this deal?
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, I'll give you a goat. And goat's pretty valuable, so that's and he offers that, but he doesn't have a goat with him. So she says, well, what are you going to give me as collateral? So he said, well, what do you want? He says, I want your signet ring. So he takes her signet. She takes his signet ring, and she holds on to that. And he would send somebody later to pick up the signet ring when he exchanged it with the goat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it turned out, she gets pregnant, and she has two sons. Now, the family gets real mad where she's living with her original family. They get real mad about her, and they tell Judah, you know, this woman is playing up as a prostitute, and he runs over, and he wants to kill her. He wants to put her to death, a family pride or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, she displays the ring to him and tells him and shows him who she is. And he says, well, you know, you're absolutely right. You're the more noble person than you. I did that. You did this, and I forgive you. And he moves on because he didn't give her he was supposed to deliver the third son when he grew up, and he didn't. So she had at least a little bit of a case of that. So Talmud doesn't, she has these two children, and this is where the story gets really interesting to me. They're twins. And the twins come out, and they don't know which one's going to come out first. So the first one does come out, or part of the first one comes out, and that's Zara, the one that will later be known as Zara. And his hand comes out, and the midwife, in order to identify that child, she wraps a scarlet thread around Zara's hand.
Mm-hmm.
And Zara pulls his hand back. And then the child who comes out in total, the whole body, is Pharis. And Pharis comes out. And they give the birthright to Pharis.
Okay.
Because he came out totally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fine because you go through the line, and we're fine with that because Pharis is the one who leads on his family line, goes all the way through Dode and then to Yosha. So obviously that was the one that y'all wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But Zara has a case, and they're kind of upset about the whole deal. And they claim through their history that they were the ones that should have been the ones that had that claim as the bearer of the scepter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we only hear about them later when they're taken away. They're in Egypt, and they're we only hear about them for three generations. And then all of a sudden they disappear from history. It happens to be about the time of the northern part, no, I'm sorry, the southern part or upper part of Egypt comes down, and they don't know Joseph anymore, and they conquer the southern part, or the lower part, the northern part of Egypt. And that's when they all become slaves, the whole family becomes enslaved in Egypt, because they know not Joseph's name anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about this, and I'm just going to put some words and some thoughts together. Just logically, I'm thinking, okay, these are pretty wealthy people. They have been running the largest, most powerful empire in the world, Egypt, Mitzrayim. And they see these people coming. They've got kind of a grudge against Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
They're into the third generation, and they take off. They're right there at the one of the best ports in the Mediterranean. They take off. Now, does history tell us anywhere they go? Well, according to the Greeks, Troy was developed. The city of Troy was built by these people from Egypt. And if you go to the symbols and stuff that they carried, that's a pretty good claim. They also find out, we also find out that a bunch of them go westward. And they go to Spain. And if you, and the historians there, they call, the grandson is a guy named Calcol. And he's the great-grandson of Zora. And he shows up on the Iberian Peninsula. Iberia is just another name for Hebrew. That's the name they gave it. It's a Greek transliteration. And in the land of Spain, they call it Iberia. They're on the Ebro River. He founds a city. This is Calcol, the great-grandson. He founds a city called Zaragoza. Later, we find some of the remnants going up to Ireland. And also to Great Britain.
Wow, that's in terms of some of the most important names.
Now, the reason we know who they are is they have a different symbol than the ones we're going to talk about later about all the 12 tribes. They have this symbol, and it's pretty cool. They take the lion is the symbol of the line of Dode, or the line of Judah.
Yeah, Yehuda.
Mm-hmm. Yehuda, and it's usually three in a crouched position.
Mm-hmm.
And Kazmi is one sitting down. The Zorite symbol that they take to Troy and they take to Spain is a lion standing up.
Ah, yes.
And they also take one of a bloodied hand, a red, and it's also red, by the way, the lion. They also take a hand that's upright, I mean a hand that's red and bloodied, and around it is a scarlet thread.
Yes.
And everywhere they go, the Zorites go, that's what they take with them even to today. You can find it all over Great Britain. You can find it all over Scotland, Ireland, and the western part of some of the western parts of, less now in Spain, but in the early history, the archaeologists found all this stuff. And they say, okay. But nobody seems to know who they are because nobody wants to associate them with that. They have, listen, they have no claim on the scepter. We know who he went through. We know who he wanted to go through, and it ain't them. But they don't know that, or they at some point they certainly had a grudge against these people. So we have another little group of, and that's the only other Yehudim other than the ones that go through the Exodus, you know. And they walked away. Yahweh didn't say go away. They went away.
Right.
So they walked away from any part of the family. And if, let's see here now, when Troy is destroyed, if you read the study of Troy, now they had several layers of cities on that, and I'm not exactly sure whether it's the founding one or the first or second one before there's a real exodus there. The history of the Zorites there is that
When is Troy founded, and when is it ultimately destroyed? What are the years?
It's about, the first time is probably about around 500.
First time it's destroyed or first time the first foundations of Troy?
Well, the foundations come about the same time of the generations, about three generations. So it should be, let's see, that would have been 14, about, if you had 400, if you had 400 years in Egypt. I didn't ask myself that question. 400 years in Egypt, they were the third generation. So it had to be within about the first 100 years while Joseph was running, Joseph's family was running Egypt. So if they didn't leave at the 400 years to about 450, it has to be around 1,000 or...
Yeah. Okay. Right, that's what I was thinking about. Right around 1,000 BCE is when Troy is really becoming meaningful. And that would be a time that that Jews would actually be able to go there.
Yeah.
And it was ultimately destroyed by the Greeks around 400 or 500 BCE.
Yeah. And then they fight back and forth, rebuild the city and so forth and so on. And that's pretty good archaeology now. That wasn't found out to about the 19th century, early 20th century anyway for definitive. But that's a group of them. It's a smaller group. The historians, at least the Greek historians, if you read them, they say that there was a group that left and went towards Spain, went to the west, and then a bunch of them went along the Caspian Sea. Is it the Caspian on the left hand? Yeah, the Caspian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, went along that thing, and then you find them, and there they meet up with the Scythians, which will relate to the House of Israel when they escape from the Persians. But you can trace them there, and it seems to go across through the northern part, up through Russia and through the northern part of Europe as well. So you have that little group of people there that most people don't even consider. But they also use them a lot, I think. It seems to be that they use them a lot as some of their claims of kingship.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that little group going. And so now let's go back to the chart. I know this is a little disjointed, but, you know, every time I do this, it's going to be that way because there's so much material to try to put together, but I think you can check this dot and connect that dot.
So kind of the advantage of talking about the this original diaspora, if you will, of Jews is that there's evidence, huge evidence through Spain and other places in Europe. Particularly now you go to Turkey and today's Turkey and Troy, that there's overwhelming evidence in both places that Jews, particularly of the tribe of Yehuda, were not only there, but extraordinarily influential, where in the case of Spain, the country was named after them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the
whole Iberian Peninsula.
Oh, right, yeah. The kind of country is named after them, but it became the national symbol. The standing lion and the red hand became the national symbol of both places.
Yeah. It's not a stretch.
Yeah. Yeah. What we don't know is if the Yehudim that went there intermarried, or if they did what Yehudim and Israelites have done throughout time, which is to marry only among themselves and to be a separate community within
a geographic
region.
They do surrender to a small group in Spain. And then there's another group that goes to, and a lot of them move off to Ireland and then on to Britain because then you can follow the trail, you know, of their symbols and so forth in archaeology that way as well. So, and eventually a lot of those names, are kept, but you find a very small group there. I guess through persecution and so forth. But interesting enough, there is information that they paid tribute to Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also what's the other Solomon connection? Is that they? I've got an old brain. You have to forgive me. But anyway, they did pay tribute to Solomon. They did. They were involved with Israel from a sense of they knew who they were and what was going on there late in later times, and then you just have to trace them all the way up through Ireland and so forth.
Yeah, and this is long before.
Symbols that we'll go through, we'll itemize. They're carrying all these long before Christianity comes, so if anyone's thinking that Christianity somehow brought all this information to them, No, this is long, long, long before that.
Yeah, this is Christianity didn't influence any of these places really until after Theodosius nationalized Roman Catholicism, where the Roman Catholic Church became what was Imperial Rome, and that was in 400 CE. So what you're dealing with now is things that preceded that by more than 1,000 years, and in some cases closer to 1,500 years.
Mm-hmm. And you can even trace it all the way when you get to Britain. The first king of Britain was called Brutus. He was Prince Brutus, and he was, you can trace him from Zara to Dardanus to Brutus on the birth charts or the chronology of the family. And Prince Brutus, of course, becomes the Brutons, and later they changed their name to the Britons.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not, and remember, keep in the back of your mind, I say this because I worry that people, because I'd like to address the British Israelite Society and understand what they did to this with this information, because all this started coming out in the 1800s, where it was pretty obvious that these were facts.
Mm-hmm.
But and it scares me, anybody in the family is listening to this, these people have no claim on anything. If you're one of these people who like to watch the Queen and think that's a big deal, God hates these people.
Right.
He didn't give her any scepter over anybody.
Right.
They can have whatever they want. And you can walk away from Yahweh, and he'll let them all rule. In fact, a lot of the things that I've listed here is exactly what Yahweh told them in Leviticus 26. Well, hopefully we can cover that, if not today, then the next time. But these people have done their thing, but God never told them so. He says, they named their own kings. He's talking about Israel later, and also these people over here. Listen, he said, I ain't got nothing to do with these things, these people.
Right.
Now, let me address the, before we go running down the road with all this neat stuff, let me address the part about the British Israelite Society, because what they did, they were a group in the 20th century, and they used all these history and all the records to prove that the British royal family had the right to rule the world and usher in the millennium. They commingled it with their Christian church and state. And they were going to spread the gospel of Christianity throughout the entire empire and all of the, their British empire and all the pagan lands. And the baton, as they say, the scepter, the law, according to King James, has been passed from Yehuda to Israel. And they were claiming they were the Israelites.
Uh-huh.
And they, yeah, there's a lot of Israelites there.
Uh-huh.
So if the thing you have to keep in mind is that if you accept, if that were true, if Yahweh passed, it's just me talking,
mm-hmm.
Y'all will pass this scepter to them. Now, when I look at the scepter, the kingship, I think of, I have little codes like STP. And to me, when a king, and the reason Dode was so, I think, so loved by Yahweh, because he became the type of king that Yahweh wanted to be to his people. He was a shepherd.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
He taught them. He was a great teacher.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant mind.
He was a great teacher.
Yeah, understanding, knew how to research, loved to learn, was spectacular at understanding, and a brilliant, brilliant communicator.
Mm-hmm.
And a passionate guy that loved life.
Yes. All the things that Yahweh loved, he saw in his, he could compare that. This is what this guy likes. This is what I like. He's my man. And he was also protective. Now, he had a couple of little places where he didn't protect too well, as we've talked about, the 70,000. But
mm-hmm.
he was basically a shepherd protecting and doing his thing. And when he loses his focus, he's like the rest of us. He's, you know, he just screws it all up. But from that standpoint, of that, if that's what a king is, what kingship is, then that was what Yahweh was looking for. That cannot be found in any of the kings, any other kings on the earth.
No.
And
they don't come from shepherds, do they?
And the law, as the King James calls it, the law, that's the Torah. The Torah is not law.
Correct.
It's instruction, teaching, guidance, and direction. If it wasn't for the law as they call it, the Torah as we know it, if it wasn't for that, we don't get the mitzvah, we don't get the chok, we don't get the familial family relationship, the covenant. We don't get the Moed Mikros. We got nothing. If any people should be loved, the Jews, the Yehudim, should be loved, because that was the promise that he gave to them, and that's what they brought to us. Otherwise, we're not even having this conversation.
Well, you know, it's what's interesting, too, is that if Christians and Muslims were actually informed. First of all, if you were informed and rational, you wouldn't be a Christian or a Muslim.
Oh, that's true.
But if they were informed and they knew that not only was Yahusha a Yahud, but that everything that he conveyed was based upon the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and he did so in Yisrael, and mostly in Jerusalem, fulfilling the Moed Mikre is all the important events in his life, that without Yahudim, without Yisrael,
there's no context at all.
They got nothing. Well, they've got literally nothing. I mean, the whole thing is just nothing, but then it's
the House of Cards.
It's a Babylonian counterfeit, bare and naked, and nothing more.
Yeah.
And with Islam, everything that's even remotely credible in the Quran and in Islam was paid for out of Talmud arguments discussing the Torah and then bastardized to suit Muhammad. You take Yehudim out of the picture, it's got no credibility. It's got nothing.
Yeah.
And so if they were the least bit enlightened, they'd realize that rather than hating these people, without them, they've got nothing.
Embrace them.
Right, they've got nothing. Literally nothing. Mm-hmm. And this is a group of people that haven't asked for anything in return.
No,
they don't want anybody else's country.
Land that they were promised to. And Yahweh said it's there, so case closed.
Yeah.
And it's a sliver, my gosh.
Represents
nothing. And the grand, look at the map.
Yeah. Far less than 0.1% of the
whole Ottoman
world's
empire that they gave away.
That's right.
Everybody
right.
just gave away. So if you're thinking of it rationally, and then you accepted the fact that Samuel has something to say about it, you can't have a king, and you can't have an army.
Right.
It's just like you're dead in the water. I mean, it's just so. In any case, so that's what the British Society, the Israelite Society, wanted the king to resign, and they were going to take over because they were the Israelites. And they would appoint their own king, and they would take over. But it's a power struggle. Everywhere you go, is who's going to be? It's like the old thing: the man who would be king. You saw it in the Zoroites just a moment ago. You see it in the British Empire days and so forth, and obviously, we're going to find out that it was very prevalent when we get to the kingdom that gets split in two after we have the Exodus, where the masses come and Moshe takes them, or Yahusha takes them into the promised land, and then they eventually break into two. So, if I'm going to find these people, one of the ways that I'm going, we have already mentioned it a minute ago, the emblems will follow suit. But I want to establish who these people are, and how they set them up. Let's fast forward. We got them out of Exodus in the last go round with you and so forth. Mm-hmm. So now they've settled into the land. But as they were traveling to that in the 40 days in the 40 years in the wilderness, he had them set up a particular way. They orient themselves towards the east, ancient Hebrews.
Right.
Where we orient to the north and the North Star and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
They orient themselves to the east. If you look on page 6 on there, that maybe we'll publish this one of these days or something if they want to. But on the east is a big box, and they set their camps this way. On the east side, you have Yehudim.
Yeah. By the way, what's interesting here, almost every religion in the world orients their temples to the sun setting on certain celestial events, winter solstice or vernal equinox, that sort of thing. And it's always the setting sun on a solar cycle.
Not the rising sun.
What Yisrael, according to Yahweh, is oriented towards the growing of the light, not to the approach of darkness, which is what happens when the sun sets,
yes,
but to the increase of light. When the at the time when light begins to flood the land and continues to increase over the next on an average of 12 hours, Mm-hmm. Increasing over 6 hours, but being brighter than the moment of the sun rising in the east for a period of 12 hours. So it's the 12 hours of light that is the orientation of Yisrael, as opposed to the 12 hours of darkness orientation of virtually every religion. That's the Egyptian temples, the Babylonian temples, Stonehenge, for example, the Mayan temples, the Aztec temples, the Inca temples. Everybody is towards the setting sun.
Yeah. Cool.
Not Yisrael.
Very good. Very good. So we've got Yehuda, we've got Yisshakar, mm-hmm. and we have Zebulun, our own, the side with Yehuda, and they pitch their camps there, and they put a flag down, as they're told to, and we can prove that. They're told to when they meet, so you know where the groups are and whose group of tents they are. And same thing with Reuben, who's on the south side, and Gad and Shimeon, he who hears, and Gad are at the southern part, and they're in camp there. And then on the western side, we have Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. And then on the north, we have Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, or Naphtali.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at their characteristics of those, you have their names alone will tell us something. We have Benjamin, of course. He is a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to all of those in a second, but it means right hand of falsehood, son of the right hand, Benjamin. You have Ephraim is double fruit, to be fruitful,
mm-hmm.
To increase. Manasseh causing to forget and be forgotten. Odd. You think it would be odd until you know the story. Asher is he's a happy guide and leader. Good for him.
Mm-hmm.
You have Dan is judgment and sail a direct course. You've got Naphtali, which is to be, this is not good, he's twisted, he wrestles, and he's cunning and crooked. That's not a good name.
No.
Don't name your son that.
No.
Yisshakar, there is recompense, there is payment. You have Yehuda, related to Yah, you know, it has a hand, a Yah, a hand that grabs hold.
Yeah.
You know, that's all really good stuff
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, the hand of Yah. Really, Yehuda, yeah, the hand of
Yehuda.
Yeah. Yeah, and the hand was meant not only support and to lift one up, but also influence and power.
Mm-hmm. And then you get Zebulun to reside and to dwell. Gad, we'll go around back to the south again. Gad, you have to invade, to raid, to attack, to penetrate, and to cut. Reuben was see the sun, S-O-N. The reason that was done, he was the firstborn. So, look, you know, joy. There's a son.
Mm-hmm.
Simeon, as it should be, one who hears.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. So that's a little glimpse of those people. And of course, the Loi are the set apart people who are joiners, and they resided in the center of the camp there.
Yeah. And what you're talking about here is that something that's really important. Is that
mm-hmm.
All of the criticism that is marshaled by the anti-Semites, whether they be Christians with the replacement theology, Islam, the Quran is the most anti-Semitic book ever written, far worse than Mein Kampf. What you have in Christianity and in Islam is this notion that Jews are bad, the Jews killed Jesus, which, of course, they didn't do, but their focus is on the Jews. And Jews is simply a corruption of the actual name of Yahud. And what you're pointing out here, that there are two very different branches of Yahud,
mm-hmm.
one of which has permeated Europe and Asia Minor, but that only represents one of 13,
mm-hmm.
or two of 13, if you think of the two divisions of Yahud.
Yeah.
And so that the vast majority of the Israelites to whom all these promises have been made are not Yahud.
No. Well, we're just stupid is what we are.
Right.
My children are lost for lack of, I think, when my children are lost for lack of knowledge.
Right. And they're not all living in Yisrael.
No.
And God didn't say they'd all be living in Israel.
No, he never did.
No.
So before probably not going to get to any of the verses here, but we can substantiate all this in God's promise, because God says this, and then you'll find that all this happens. But let's go on. If you're following along with me, I've got a page 6 which has all the emblems of the 12 tribes. So let's go through some of these and see what they had these symbols. Now we've established, and God's going to tell them, this is the way you line up, and this is where you put your emblem, where you put your flag, your upright pole that identifies you. For life, forever. And they do. Reuben, his primary emblem, is a man. Reuben was a normal human being, frail, strong in all the things that he was strong about, but he was also just a man. He was subject to everything, that frailties of men as well. He had a secondary emblem, some of them don't, which is a body of water. He was wishy-washy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, standard man.
He was easily swayed.
Right. Right, and the body of water, of course, is also the sea is symbolic of the influence of man versus the influence of God.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, and being even though he is part of the tribe of Yisrael, it's also suggesting that his descendants are going to live in various places around the world.
Yeah. Yes, I would go along with that with no problem. Shimeon, his primary symbol was a sword, and also his secondary was a castle gate. So he was he and his brother killed some guy or something, and so they were also a castle gate there. So they're always pictured that way. Wherever you find them, wherever you find a symbol with a sword and a secondary with a castle gate, you know there's some Simeon or Shimeons that started there too.
Yeah, of course. You look at the royal clans of Europe, and there's lots of particularly with the British, the Irish, the Scottish. Lots of castle gates. Castle gate imagery throughout that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. You've got Dan. I'm sorry, Yehuda. Let's do Yehuda again. Obviously, he's a lion, and his three lions. Interesting here. The primary one, of course, is the lion, and it's usually sitting down.
And somebody might say, well, you know, that's not fair just to trace that, because, like, for example, Babylon had no influence from Yehuda to have a lion, and lion was their emblem. But
they had to have, the answer to that one is they had to have, like the Persians, for instance, too. They had to have, maybe I'm confusing, but they had to have the wings on the lion.
Well, of course, that's what I was going to say. The difference is
Babylonian,
Assyrian,
Persian
lion was always a winged
lion picture.
Right.
And it had these little tiny wings on it.
Yeah.
And they speculated, now, wait a minute, why didn't they put the big wings on it? Well, they probably wanted their symbol to show. This is what they argue, and I think that makes sense. They wanted to, but they put the little lions on there so nobody would get them. Remember, they were enslaved.
Yeah.
So that's the only place, but they knew even then, most people agree, you have to have some wings on it, and he doesn't have any. Yehuda doesn't have any.
That is correct.
On his. Now, he has also three lions laying down.
Yeah, and the winged lion is really a celestial, that's Leo, that's the constellation, know, so it's dealing with astrology. It's not doing, the animal kingdom, the lion really is amongst the most noble of animals.
Yeah.
You know, it lives within a pride, even the word pride talks about the nobility, if you will. It's a it's a far more regal animal, and it's that's the reason for that particular symbol.
Yeah. Well, their secondary is the same thing. It has three lions in a row, and you'll find that symbol all over. But you also have a scepter, and you also have a grapevine.
Yeah. All important symbols.
All important for Yehuda. Then you have Dan. Now, Dan's a different cat, man. He's a serpent. And because he bites at the feet of the horse. And a horse, also a secondary, is a horse. And also a lion and an eagle.
Boy, we're going to have to pick this up and then talk about the promises in another program.
Okay.
Thank you.